Today we have Professor Richard Mooney on the podcast. Rich is the George Barth Geller Professor of Neurobiology at Duke University. Dr. Mooney, thanks for joining us today.
It's a real pleasure. Nice to be here, Joe.
Yeah. Welcome back to Florida. So you study vocal communication, sensory motor integration in a really cool system, traditionally the songbird, the zebra finch, and other songbirds. And we want to talk to you about that and some of the other model organisms that you work in to study the circuitry of vocal communication. But what is it about the songbird that's particularly interesting to a neuroscientist?
I mean, what isn't? There's almost nothing that I could say that could fail to convey how beautiful these animals are. The behavioral richness is there, that's for sure. And although our group does a lot of work in mouse now, as well as in bird, the bird just beats everything hands down in terms of behavioral power. They learn how to sing. They have beautiful songs. They do them really, really precisely for us over and over again with no reinforcement. It's all good.
So what is it exactly that, I mean, a lot of birds sing, right? What exactly makes a songbird a specific kind of bird, right?
Well, yeah, Misha, that's right. So when I say songbird, I mean, for a general audience, many, many different types of birds sing or produce complicated vocalizations. Songbirds refer to just one group. It's taxonomically you'd call it a suborder, and that's the ossine birds, the ossini. And they're in the order Passeriformes, the perching birds. They're really, really common birds. They're distributed almost worldwide.
So these are like sparrows and finches?
Exactly. Sparrows, finches, cardinals, jays, crows. It's wide-ranging. What distinguishes them, or at least one thing that does, is that they learn to sing. They transmit their courtship songs from one generation to the next through a process that involves listening and then vocally copying a model, usually produced by the male parent.
So why is it that the male birds are predominantly the ones that sing? Is there something about the function of bird song that evolutionarily the males have been selected to be the primary courters, I guess?
That's a good question. So it's not true that all species of songbirds are dimorphic and sexually dimorphic with respect to singing. There are examples of species where both sexes sing. But the typical pattern, especially in temperate zone species, is the male sings. Why is that? There is a tendency in warm-blooded vertebrates for males to display and to, in a sense, both advertise and compete for females. That just may reflect that general tendency that the males are out there trying to
showboat
and, you know, and successfully recruit a mate. But I don't have a deeper answer for that.
It's a mystery.
Yeah, it is a mystery. I mean, you know, just one thing about this, I mean, you know, the bird song system has proven really, really rich for a lot of things. I mean, my draw to neuroscience was not because I was interested in studying birds per se or studying bird song, but because I'm really interested in music. I love music. And I studied music really intensively for a long time. As I did, I got more and more drawn into what's going on here? How am I hearing this? And why does it sound good or not so good? Or why do I like this? Why am I drawn to do it? How do I go from listening to something to being able to play it? Of course, most all of us go through this when we learn how to speak, but we're not really conscious of it in the way most people are when they learn to play a musical instrument. And that's really was my first draw into neuroscience. And birds just happen to be, and songbirds particularly, a really, really powerful system for addressing those kinds of issues.
Are there parallels between how a songbird learns to acquire its vocal communication and how a human learns to acquire its vocal communication?
The parallels are many and deep. At the behavioral level, it's almost directly analogous. That is, song learning in birds is almost directly analogous to speech learning in humans. There's a requirement for an appropriate vocal model. That would be the speech sounds of our parents and peers when we're growing up. And for a young songbird, it's the song of a tutor, usually a conspecific bird, that is a member of its own species. And then there's a requirement for both vocal practice. You have to try to make the appropriate sounds, and that's not easy. And you have to do that in reference both to the model that you heard when you were young. We do that, and so do juvenile songbirds. And in reference to your own performance on a trial-by-trial basis. If I say it one way this time, is it closer or further away from what I wanted to sound like? And again, you know, for most of us, when we learn to speak, we're just in a sort of, I don't know if it's really preconscious, but typically people don't have a very clear idea of what their preverbal infancy and early childhood was like. We don't really bring that to mind. Some people would say, well, it's because we didn't have language yet. And so forming the narrative of our early life is difficult without that, but it may also just reflect that these capacities are developing in parallel.
I think one interesting thing that might be we should mention is maybe the difference in fitness between humans and songbirds. For example, I mean, so what is the necessity in fitness for, or in survival, I guess, in Darwinism, for these birds to have this pronounced sensory motor mechanism?
Yeah, right. So that's a really deep question. And it's deep in the sense that birdsong is a learned behavior, but it's under strong sexual selection pressure. And Darwin noted that, you know, probably sexual selection was as powerful or potentially more powerful than natural selection for shaping speciation. And at least in cases where biologists have been able to track the linkage between a sexually dimorphic trait and fitness, there's a direct relationship between the sexually selected trait, you know, whether it be, you know, the size of the antlers or plumage, or I know this has been done discreetly in certain flies that have a certain, I think their eyes are on stalks, and the females select the males based on the inner eye distance. It turns out that when you have the genetic power like you do in some fly systems, you can actually identify a linkage to reproductive fitness. And that's the sense that you mean fitness,
mm-hmm.
is what, you know, what advantage to reproduction does the female accrue by mating with a male that learns to sing? There's no clear idea. One notion, and I think this has not been strongly supported in the final analysis, is that song is learned during a pretty prolonged period after hatching. It's a period when the juveniles are strongly dependent on the adults for feeding. And so one notion is that the an adult female can listen to an adult male song and discern something about how well he was parented or cared for by his parents by listening to the quality of his song. And in fact, my colleagues at Duke, Steve Nowicki and Susan Peters, have nutritionally stressed birds, young birds, and found out that the phonology, the quality of the copying of individual syllables, is impaired if the birds are, you know, sort of calorically deprived during a sensitive period. So that could be an explanation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like this this honest signal that you get to show your mate that you come from sort of a healthy bird family, right? And you'll be able to reproduce that yourself.
Exactly right, Misha.
And
so does that mean that there's a reason that, like, rock stars and get all the girls here?
Is that still true? I feel like that's from the 80s.
It was true for me in high school.
That was true for my generation, Ben. I don't know about today. I've kind of gotten out of the loop. But, you know, we see it. I mean, you know, super athletes, you know, celebrities. I mean, there's kind of this recruitment effect. What their equivalents are in the songbird world, I have no idea.
Yeah, when I was in graduate school working in songbirds, it was oftentimes people would talk about it in terms of a sexy song. So they would try to figure out what were the characteristics of a song that made it particularly attractive to a female. But it seemed like a lot of those studies were very difficult because you have to, it's one thing to make a songbird reliably sing, it's harder to get a female to reliably be receptive to a song. So do we know any of the specific sound features that females key in on that are being selected for?
over a single trial, there are, in I think a somewhat anecdotal sense, just certain syllables in canary song that are considered sexy syllables, and they seem to be more likely to elicit a receptive response in females. But the female's not just looking for single trial performance. So something about the trial-to-trial performance really matters to the female, too. And Joe, I think you're probably familiar with this literature, but zebra finches, which are commonly used for songbird neurobiology, the adult males sing and the females select males based on their song. The males will sing by themselves. That's called undirected song. Or they will sing toward a female. That's called directed song. And the undirected song and the directed song to our ears sound essentially identical. But it turns out the undirected song is just a little bit slower, and by that I mean it's like, you know, 30 or 40 milliseconds slower over a song rendition, so about 5 to 10% slower. And it's slightly more variable trial to trial. Again, to our ears, we don't hear it. But females that have mated with a male and listen either to his directed song or his undirected song completely ignore the undirected song and treat it, in fact, as if it's the song of a strange male. Hmm. So they're very, that must require some integration over many performances. And so that stereotypy and reduced variability seems to matter quite a bit to the female. There's another idea, getting back to Ben's question about what is it that the female is selecting for. Of course, you know, fitness in the broad sense, I mean, birds fly, and flight is the most metabolically taxing form of locomotion by far. Really, really energetically demanding, and birds have a plethora of specializations, light and bones, very, very powerful respiratory systems that don't suffer from the limitations ours do, i.e., they don't have tidal volume exchange in the distal part of their lungs. They have a unidraft respiratory system that's quite amazing. And, you know, it's possible that one bit of information that the female can get from song is something about the respiratory capacity of the male. And in fact, song can be extremely demanding, and in some species the song bouts last for many tens of seconds. The animal is going into oxygen debt while it's doing that. Some species actually sing during flight. So there may be some information the female can get about something that matters if you're a bird.
Right, about the physiological fitness of the animal and the ability for it to make its journey south or something.
Yeah, right. You know, like this is a bird that's a good flyer, but maybe you're learning about it without having to observe it.
Absolutely, yeah. Right. Yeah.
So I'd like to, if we could move on to kind of the critical periods and how song learning deals with that. So this is something that's particularly interesting to me. I grew up around a lot of immigrant families, and I come from an immigrant family, right? So we relocated to the U.S. when I was 7 years old, and for the most part, I don't have any kind of accent coming from Russia. But friends of mine who came a little later, you know, you come at 9 or 10 or 11 years old, you end up kind of talking a bit like this for the rest of your life, and you can't do anything about it, right? But people who are younger speak without an accent. It's almost as like there's an exact time window in which you have to come to be able to sort of learn a language without an accent. And with birds, it's fairly similar. Like there's a specific amount of time in which they can learn the song. And do these birds completely lose the ability to learn songs after a while? And these birds have different dialects. Can they switch from one to the other? How does it work?
Not readily. So again, that's another, you know, I sort of got cut short in the parallels. I mean, the behavioral parallels extend to sensitive periods. That again is very similar between humans and songbirds, although the absolute durations of those periods are different. But you're right, in humans, it's really well documented in part by the fortunate immigration of people to the U.S. over, you know, decades, and tracking their native fluency in English as a function of age at immigration to the United States. And it's very clear there's a roll-off around 10 to 12 years of age. In fact, the dip during adolescence and then a slight recovery post-adolescence. But you're right. I mean, all sorts of features. I mean, it's not just accent, it's grammar and syntax. are the native language fluency all requires pretty early exposure and immersion. In birds, it's exactly the same. I mean, in most species, if they don't hear an appropriate model by about the end of the second month after hatching, they become committed to whatever it is they have heard, or in the situation in which they heard no model at all, they're kind of like wild children in the sense that they develop these isolate-type songs that are just very, very crude. There's some debate, maybe in some species there's a tendency to, there's certainly a tendency in some songbird species to continue to modify song at later stages in life, but whether those animals are actually memorizing new material and copying it, that's I think much less well established. And again, going back to the classical literature, I mean, I remember talking to Peter Marler about this, who was kind of the granddaddy of birdsong behavioral research, and he said, as far as he knew, there was really no evidence of memorization that extended beyond the second or maybe the third month after hatching. And then the animals committed to reproducing that memory in a way that, you know, is pretty inflexible.
I wonder if we could talk about what to me has been sort of one of the historical frameworks for understanding how a bird learns its song. So when you have a juvenile zebra finch that's presented with, say, its father, its tutor, who's singing in front of it, it was commonly thought that, you know, a period of time can go by where the bird might not even sing, where it has listened to the father's song for a while, and then eventually it'll start practicing it. You could have removed the father for a period of time, and it'll recapitulate the father's song, even in the absence of constant access to that model that it's learning. And so I think my understanding was people were thinking that there must be some kind of template that's stored in the bird's head that it's referring to when it's doing practice. It's spitting out what it thinks is the right syllables or sounds, bird sounds, and then it's hearing the feedback itself. The auditory feedback back into the brain is being compared against some kind of template. But it seems like recent evidence from you and maybe some of the machine learning community has been putting forth a model that maybe doesn't require a template. Is this template model losing favor in the birdsong
world? Wait, what's the alternative to the template model?
A forward model.
So
we talked about forward models.
A blank slate? So you're talking about a blank slate versus a predetermined template that exists before experience, is that right?
Yeah, I think it. You know, we talked about forward models when we were discussing cerebellar circuits a couple weeks ago.
That's true.
Basically, it sort of changes what you might expect to see in terms of error signals, like how that bird knows if it's doing correct or incorrect things. Is there a template in the bird's head somewhere? And if so, what form does that take?
Well, the word template's really loaded, and most bird song biologists now avoid using it because it's so often misunderstood. Mark Kanishi is the person who actually coined that phrase in a really beautiful
study. He was your graduate advisor.
He was my graduate advisor, and he, actually working with Peter Marler as a graduate student himself back in the early mid-60s at UC Berkeley, he published a paper that demonstrated that songbirds, or at least white-crowned sparrows, a type of songbird, uses auditory feedback to learn to sing. And he used the word template not to invoke memory, but to imply some internal referent against which the bird compared its auditory feedback to. And Mark was very clear in saying that, look, the template doesn't necessarily have to do anything with memory, because even birds that are raised in isolation from a tutor still need auditory feedback in order to learn their isolate song. They've formed no memory at all. They end up singing a song that's very simple compared to the wild-type song, but they have some presumably genetically programmed representation against which their own performance is compared. I think the crux of the issue is that there has to be a comparison between what the bird remembered hearing and what it's listening to now as it sings. That happens entirely through a forward mechanism, I think, is unlikely. in some cases, and we were discussing this earlier today, some songbirds copy things that are completely arbitrary. I mean, things that are artificial. They can be sounds like car alarms. They can be the sounds that other animals, not even other birds, make. And in a really beautiful study Tim Gardner published in the early 2000s, he showed that he could make a random walk song where no two syllables were the same frequency, modulation rate, or same duration, and they just walked through FM space and duration space in a continuous manner. These were like canary songs, but they had no repeated phrase structure, and they were long, about 30 seconds long of sound. Again, we'd listen to it and say, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to reproduce that. But a young canary exposed to that sound stream will then many months later reproduce that random walk exactly or almost perfectly.
Wow.
So that I don't think is easy to explain with a Ford model, because the sequence and everything is so well copied. But that a Ford model could become part of the mechanism, I think, is very reasonable. Like after you've learned how to sing.
Mm.
You might use a Ford model to
maintain
a stable song, or maybe you learn certain elements you copy, but then you use that ability based on learning by imitation to drive other kinds of learning that occur during birdsong. And we like to put a lot of emphasis in the birdsong community on copying, because it's really so impressive when we see it in birdsong. But if all they did was copy perfectly, all birds would sound the same, or all birds of a certain
right.
species would sound the same, and they don't. And they innovate and they improvise, and maybe part of that process, that generative process, is a product of something that involves a Ford model.
This might be a loaded question, but do you have the sense that these birds of this age are consciously aware of copying this song? Like, and I'm thinking about this specifically in the sense of what Misha was mentioning before about picking up a dialect, which we generally, I think, as humans associate that as being subconscious, as opposed to learning how to sing or learning to play the guitar when you're an adolescent or something. You're actively thinking about what you're doing and the motor actions that are involved with making the correct notes. So I'm curious.
But you're asking if birds have consciousness, essentially.
No, that's the question.
Baby birds.
Maybe this is.
And are they conscious and smart and intuitive? Is your question?
Well, they're plenty smart.
No, is it just sort of a biological mechanism that's just kind of acting like a machine, or are they? Is there any studies that point to the fact that they represent that they make it? Did they show that they have made an error and that they're actively trying to fix that error or things like that? Is there any sort of data to assess?
Is it painful when they make an error?
Yeah, are they upset?
That's an important question. Is, you know, what is the motivation to copy well as juveniles? And presumably part of it is a sense that, oh, that's not a good match. I mean, I think a lot of what has happened in the birdsong world is people have tuned into reinforcement learning as a likely substrate for the motor learning phase of the process. And, you know, one idea is that that's driven by detecting error between the intended outcome and the actual outcome and using that error signal to drive it. But one way to optimize learning rates is to not only negatively reinforce the behavior, but to positively reinforce it. And, you know, I mean, a lot of the kinds of learning we do, especially when we're young, don't involve negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
That's one of the things, again, I think that's very powerful about the birdsong system. It's not to say that other animal models aren't incredibly useful, but there aren't many examples where animals outside of humans learn what is a very complex behavior almost purely from internal reinforcement mechanisms. Birds that are learning to sing, they don't need any reinforcement at all that we know of to copy well. You can put them in isolation in a box and give them seed and water, and, you know, 6 months later, they're producing a perfect copy of what they heard early in life.
So it's sort of like an intrinsic motivation.
That would, when I think about it, I think that it must be innately rewarding for the bird to sing. And what's curious about it is, in most species, there's no reinforcement. There's not necessarily social reinforcement or there doesn't need to be. In humans, presumably social reinforcement for speech and spoken language is really important, and dissociating those is impractical, unethical, and so on. In birds, you can see very clear evidence that they're, internally reinforcing this complicated behavior. So I can't get to the deeper question of consciousness. That's kind of above my pay grade. But
bad word
but
choice.
No. But I think, they're highly motivated to do it. They're in a sense driven to do it. And as again we discussed earlier today, before the podcast, these are behaviors that if they don't learn, they're kind of facing a dead end. They're not going to be able to successfully court a mate and reproduce.
So I think this might be a good time to sort of talk a little bit about some of your recent work. And just by way of giving a personal anecdote, anytime in graduate school when I would open up a paper from your lab, I would always be astounded that you seem to have perfectly nailed down the question you wanted to ask, and you would adopt a whole plethora of tools to answer that. So in a Rich Mooney paper, you'll see intracellular recordings in singing birds, and you'll see spine imaging, and you'll see two-photon imaging, and you'll see all sorts of different stuff. And now you've done a lot of work recently in mice. So I wonder what it is about sensory and motor circuits in mice that you were drawn to. Is it just another tool to ask specific questions, or is there something that you haven't necessarily been able to address in birds that mice are more tractable for studying?
Well, first things first, those are very nice things to say about work from our group, but it's just that. I mean, that we've done these, studies with the range of techniques that we have to ask certain questions and maybe answer them is a product of my group's effort. And I've been really fortunate. I've had a lot of really good people come through my group who have been really, really quick to adopt new techniques and to apply them in really creative ways. And, I can name all of them, but it's basically everybody who's come through my group over the past two decades at Duke. So that's a preamble. But what the mouse buys you is it's just great genetic toolkit. There's nothing like it that you can do in the bird. And at a certain point for circuit analysis, you need it. I mean, the tools shouldn't necessarily define the question, but there are certain classes of questions that become very hard to answer without intersectional genetic methods and cell type specific manipulations. And we're living in a golden age for neuroscience research. I started graduate school in 1984. I was really lucky to work with Jim Hudspeth at UCSF before I started grad school, and I got exposed there with Jim to state-of-the-art biophysics and what really, really elegant experimental science can look like. And of all the people I've interacted with, he's one of the most elegant experimentalists I've ever known. So that was there, and there was an understanding where you needed to go with it. But really for 15 years or more after that, it was really just a thought experiment. And not to oversell optogenetics, but that in itself has been a game changer. But when that's mapped onto, and similar techniques are mapped onto circuits using genetically selective methods, driver lines, intersectional expression techniques, and the like, that advances you into a realm of circuit analysis you just can't get to in most other non-mouse, non-fly systems. And that's been great. So that's part of it. Part of it is I actually did work in mammals as a postdoc. I even worked in mouse, did some early physiological characterization in one of the first neural transgenic lines, the NR1 knockout mouse. So I had that experience, but I didn't see a point until more recently where I had a question I really wanted to go after in the mouse that I thought was interesting. And I felt like this work on motor to sensory interactions, which was starting to emerge in our bird work, would be a really ripe theme to develop in the mouse. And so far, it's looked interesting.
yeah, I mean, maybe you can elaborate a little bit about what that that concept is and those questions, what those questions revolve around for the sensory motor, why you moved into mouse.
Right. Yeah. And again, to be clear, I would say we're now running in parallel in the group, and half of my lab is very focused on bird and the other half in mouse. So yeah, Ben, almost everybody has a classical view of how the brain works or how the nervous system works. And there's a famous woodcut showing Descartes' view of the nervous system. There's a figure crouching near a fire, and his heel is too close to the flame, and it activates a tube in his leg and excites animal spirits that then go up into the brain, and that initiates a reflex. And even though today we know that view is in some ways not correct, the
animal spirits.
The animal spirits part was not quite right. But the tubes. That sensory to motor transformation still governs a lot of how we think about how we operate in the world and how our nervous systems operate. But in fact, that can't be so. In that we're operating with sensory transducers, even the very fastest of them, that are looking backward in time. But in terms of our behavior, we don't behave in a way that's reflexive to something that's happening in the past. We're operating and interacting with objects. I mean, you can see it every time you watch a baseball game. You know, if a batter were reacting to cues that were, in a sense, not predictive and forecasting, they'd never get the bat off their shoulder. And there are many things, many more subtle aspects of our behavior where that's the case. And that's something that really drew me in. And part of it, again, goes back to music. I played a lot of music, and there are a lot of learning how to play music is about preparing yourself for not just what you just did or what you're doing now, but what's going to come next. So there's a lot of sort of advanced preparation and technique. And I think that's just a general quality of how our brain works. But that gets a lot less attention historically because the sensory to motor transformation is very basic. It's real. You can demonstrate it with reflexes, for example, as Sherrington did more than 100 years ago. But our brains are also doing something else, which is more subtle and not so maybe obvious to us, which is essentially telling our sensory systems that this is an estimation of what will happen as a consequence of our movement.
So part of that leads you to wonder, how do the consequences of our movements impact our sensory experience, and how does our brain basically cancel out some of maybe the less behaviorally relevant stuff that is just an artifact of our behavior from things in the world that might be relevant to attention or trying to get something done. So some of the stuff you've been doing recently has been looking at projections from motor cortex to auditory cortex. What are you finding with this interaction between the motor and sensory system that has been surprising to you?
Well, the biggest surprise was just that these movement-related signals are engaged by an extremely wide range of movements, big and small, vocal and non-vocal. That's surprising to me. What's reassuring is that there's an emerging literature from human brain imaging that, in fact, non-vocal behaviors also modulate auditory cortical activity. So it's a recent publication from Resnick's group in Journal of Neuroscience showing that, in fact, finger movements, moving the index finger rhythmically actually modulates auditory cortical activity in the contralateral hemisphere, which is very consistent with the known architecture of these motor cortical to auditory cortical projections, which are ipsilateral to the auditory cortex and cross to the upper limb periphery. So that makes sense. So I would say the you know, widespread nature of these signals, I think, you know, to really give this system full scope, I mean, we're only scratching the tip, you know, the very surface of this, in the sense that there are multiple movement-related signals. The movement-related signals impinge on the auditory neuraxis at many levels, all the way from the periphery. For example, during loud vocalization, there's an acoustic reflex that tenses the muscles of the middle ear, the tensor tympani and the stapedius muscles, to dampen the coupling between the eardrum and the oval window of the inner ear and reduce the strength of auditory feedback. As I mentioned, Nate Sautel has beautiful work recording in the dorsal cerebellar, or cochlear nucleus, excuse me, that shows that, which I think Nate would say is
cerebellar nucleus.
excuse me, that's where the slip came from. The DCN shows a cancellation signal that's quite profound for mastication, a variety of other movements, orofacial movements. So these signals are widespread. And, you know, what we really want to know is whether or not these corticocortical signals are important to learning and learning to predict acoustic consequences of movement.
So is it, I'm going to ask a question that I, and I'm going to rephrase this question in editing, but I'm going to ask a question about the motor theory of speech perception. So now that there's from your work, you have this nice illustration of how motor cortex can have an impact on auditory cortex for signal conditioning or something like that. And you also have results suggesting that motor activity affects the perception of sounds. Is there any indication that the way we derive meaning from speech sounds has anything to do with motor cortex? Because there's been a sort of this theme that kind of comes and goes in popularity that one of the ways in which we understand speech sounds is that there's some kind of transformation of those into the motor act that would generate those sounds. So it's sort of like
a mirror neuron type thing.
Is this at all related to what you're starting to discover here?
Well, Lieberman, who championed the idea of a motor theory of speech perception, I think, to paraphrase his idea, thought that speech perception depended upon activation of the same circuits that produce those sounds, and that the only way we gain access to the meaning of speech sounds is by essentially comparing internally the activity patterns that are elicited by the sounds with reference to the motor circuits that produce the same sound. So it's almost like where we get speech perception from is by essentially simulating the internal motor patterns that would produce that same speech sound. That probably in its most concrete form is wrong, because we can perceive many sounds that we can't vocally produce. Certainly the range of auditory perception isn't limited by the ability to make the sound. Any musician, including myself, can tell you that. There are a lot of sounds I wish I could make and I can't, but I can still appreciate them, and that's probably why we're drawn to great performance in musicians. But I think the really, deep aspect about brain function is that at the apex of sensory motor loops, there is evidence of equivalencies between the sensory and motor representations. We've seen that explicitly in the songbird, in the apex of the sensory motor hierarchy for singing. There are individual neurons that are active during listening to a song and to producing that same song, and the activity associated with production is premotor or motor related. It's not auditory. That looks a lot like the mirror neurons that have been described in frontal regions of the macaque brain by Giacomo Rizzolatti and his coworkers in the visual motor domain, that are active when the animal is either observing certain gestures, usually grasping movements with the contralateral forepaw, and executing those same grasping movements. And there they've been able to similarly show that the visually evoked activity during observation is obviously sensory in nature, but that the activity during the execution is premotor in nature. So there is this equivalency, and that's something that's quite distinct. The sensory epithelium and the effectors for movement are physically separate for the most part, But there is a merging of sensory and motor representations that I think in some cases can become very explicit. And what the brain is doing with that information, whether it's, you know, using that equivalency to allow the motor system to make a prediction about the acoustic consequences of vocal motor commands, or it's using that capacity to allow sensory stimuli to reactivate certain motor or premotor networks, I think that's not clear. But in birdsong, one of the ways in which birds use song is they listen to what the other bird sings, and then they sing back to it. And if they have a song that's very much like what was just sung to them, they'll choose that song. So you can imagine in that kind of antiphonal behavior that having this sort of sensory motor correspondence could be very useful for, oh yeah, I know how to do that. I'm going to look that one up and sing it right back to you. We probably do that too.
One thing that I do think about, and I'm not sure whether you have, well, you can add to it or not, but is in terms of your work in the corollary discharge and the sensory motor integration and the ability for us to sort of hear our voice, our own voices, and, you know, all the different ways that we can self-correct. But, you know, maybe you know that recently there's, in the last 10 years, there's been a huge advancement in cochlear implants, and there's all these awesome YouTube videos you can go up and look and see these people who are basically getting an implant
and hearing for the first time.
Hearing for this first time because they had a, you know, peripheral damage or peripheral degeneration, and then they have a implant that's put in, and then they can begin to hear. So I guess at a first pass, in terms of your research, I guess I'm interested in knowing whether there's these connections between premotor areas and the auditory area, given that these people have, you know, not been able to really hear clearly or hear at all, depending on, and this is not the first time, so I don't know if there's any research out about it or if you know anything, but I mean, that just seems like a really interesting avenue to think about sensory motor integration and audition.
Right, so I mean, cochlear implants are a miracle, literally. I mean, probably of all the neuroprostheses talked about or actually developed, this is the one that has struck gold. And I'm really fortunate at Duke. Blake Wilson is there, and he's one of the prime movers in cochlear implant technology. He won the Lasker Prize a few years ago for his work in cochlear implant development. Just a superb scientist, and I've seen people firsthand who've benefited after profound hearing loss in adolescence or adulthood, you know, benefited tremendously and recovered not just speech function and conversational function, but in some cases even musical function, which is really, really hard to do with an implant because the number of spectral channels is so few.
Right, right, yeah.
And in music, it turns out, you know, having a lot of spectral resolution really matters to
right.
musical enjoyment. I know of the YouTube videos that you speak of people are hearing for the first time. I think where it's really true profound deafness and then later cochlear implant intervention, there are good outcomes, but it's much more complicated. When we have already gained mastery earlier in life in developing the correspondence between motor gestures and sounds, then reacquiring some of that capacity and also parsing the speech stream and making sense of it is easier to do with an implant than starting from scratch. And I think it's still been a big challenge in the CI, you know, development to bootstrap people from a non-hearing state at birth to a functional state where they can acquire spoken language.
So essentially, if somebody learned to hear when they were a child, they lose that ability later on, and then they get a cochlear implant, it's much easier for them to kind of get back into hearing, as opposed to if somebody is 50 years old and hears for the first time, then it really, you know, the brain mechanisms essentially aren't there.
Well, what's not there is not clear.
Right.
And what happens, I mean, we all know from our studies of sensory processing and sensory deafferentation that the central nervous system is really dynamic, and in the absence of an input, it does other things, and I can attest to this firsthand because I have a pretty significant hearing loss in both ears in the high frequencies and a pretty strong additional notch in my right ear. And I have central tinnitus that's pretty pronounced. Like I hear it right now. It's like a kind of a pink noise sheen to everything that's almost in front of everything else I hear. It's very annoying. That's the equivalent of a phantom limb type percept. It's sort of, you know, you don't have the input anymore, and central structures are saying, well, you know, maybe I can compensate by, you know, some homeostatic mechanism to replace the lost afferent. Again, you know, getting back to the question of what's possible, I think with speech, what's interesting about speech is that once we get it, once we develop the capacity, it's really robust. It's a really, really robust signal. And one way you can demonstrate it is you can take a recording of speech in a language you can comprehend, and you can time reverse large pieces of it, like 50 to 100 milliseconds. Just reverse it. Just, you know, arbitrarily swap the order of those segments, and you play it back, and you still hear it intelligibly. Mm-hmm. So there's some markers or anchors that our auditory system can get a hold of, and even when there's a lot of noise or distortion in between, we can still pull out the signal. What people who don't have any hearing and go through the sensitive period for speech learning can do with cochlear implants is less certain. And a challenge with cochlear implant technology is that the head continues to grow and the cochlea continues, I think, to grow some, but I think mostly it's head size. And so putting an implant in it at birth is tricky because the dimension, the length of the lead to the actual stimulating end in the cochlea has to become longer. And so I think that presents problems for doing the surgery really early. In the last meta-analysis I read of cochlear implants in children who were born without hearing or had sensory neural deficits, the speech learning outcomes were mixed best.
But it, I mean, so essentially it sounds more or less like a good place to give a plug for basic research and the necessities for, I mean, it seems like, I shouldn't say plug, but given that I just say the word plug because that's what this institute was founded on, but it's what I'm invested into as well, but we'll cut all of that out. So.
No, we will not. We leave everything that makes Ben sound dumb.
Yeah, no, I mean, it just definitely sounds like one of the even given the great advantages of the cochlear implant, with the research that you're doing and many others, that getting a better understanding of the plasticity involved with sensory motor integration and auditory processing is not only going to benefit our understanding of how our brains are able to do this, but also hopefully give us a better understanding about how these people could utilize this tool and better.
I think it goes a lot further than that. I mean, you know, what makes us human is our ability to learn throughout life and to learn and continue to engage this tremendous reservoir of neuroplasticity to refine our understanding of the world that we're in, to develop new tools, to explore. I mean, when we're talking about, you know, putting a telescope in space that's looking to the edge of the known universe and giving us pictures of that, and we're doing flybys at the very edge of our solar system and, in fact, have probes now outside of our solar system, we're a really, really amazing species. And we're amazing in large part because of our capacity to learn. That's a lifelong ability, and sensitive periods are not. Humans have a capacity to learn that's really profound, and I think that's both a basic science issue and also something of tremendous clinical importance, because that plasticity is, you know, something that's really advantageous in therapy and also can be confounding in recovery from central injury, including hearing loss, as, you know, I mentioned with tinnitus, but also following stroke, the reactive processes that are triggered by lesions to certain parts of the central nervous system. Those are in part a consequence of ongoing compensation and plasticity that our brains are capable of. That can be both adaptive or maladaptive. Mm-hmm.
Professor Mooney, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, Misha, Joe, Ben, it's been great. You guys have a great system down here.
Nice.
Really, really nice.
Thank you. Right.
Thanks
thank
for
you.
Having me on.
We'll
absolutely.
See you next time.
Yeah, good.
This has been a production by the Max Planck Florida Institute for Neuroscience. You can listen in on iTunes or SoundCloud. Follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Neuropodcast.